Good morning, Your Honors. Henry Hyman, I'm here for the appellants, Beth and Barry Beal. I have sitting at counsel table with me my partner, Susan Kaufman. May it please the court. The case today involves a very critical issue in Delaware law, and that issue is how land is to be transferred. And how land is to be transferred, not in the normal way that we are used to, which is by real estate contract where it is written, but rather by a real estate contract that has been found, that has been established, and we believe, by the Court of Chancery erroneously. For real estate to be specifically enforced, it requires that each element of a contract be proven beyond a clear and convincing evidence standard. And in addition, there must be an establishment that the purchaser is ready, willing, and able to purchase the property at all relevant times.
When you said beyond a clear and convincing standard, do you mean by a clear and convincing
yes,
standard?
Yes, sir. I apologize, Your Honor.
I may have misheard. I just
No. I misspoke. The three critical issues that establish the contract are the price, the configuration, that is, what is the property to be bought and sold, and the date on which that transaction is to take place.
What was the evidence that would support a conclusion that the closing date was really a material issue to the parties? In other words, that it was important, as opposed to a reasonable period of time for closing.
I can't say there's evidence to support the fact that it was an essential term, as that term is used in normal real estate parlance. That is, when it is put in the real estate contract, that it is an essential term. However, I would suggest to the court that if it is not in the contract itself, as in this case, being oral, it is not, still you must look to a reasonable standard as to what is a reasonable time, a commercially reasonable time, for a contract to take place. We believe that in this situation, the only date that is in fact a date that we can't talk about is November 2nd of 1999, a date on the July 31st unexecuted contract. After that, there is no date. There is no date upon which there can be concluded that there is a time for which there will be settlement. There are discussions, we believe, very infrequently. There is the filing and approval of the record plan, but after that, there is nothing. The record plan is approved in March of 2000. Nothing occurs, as far as we are concerned, as far as the record established, until November of that year, when counsel for the purchaser sends a letter and a, what might be called, a draft HUD-1 settlement sheet to the Beals, and he includes in that letter a statement that it has not yet been seen by the purchaser, Mr. Walton, and therefore anything that is contained in it is dependent upon his approval at a later date. After that, nothing happens. There's a discussion by both parties, they acknowledge, in April of 2001, to no effect. Finally, in November 2001, a letter is sent by Mrs. Beal to Mr. Walton saying, are you seriously interested in buying this property? And if you are, here are the terms and conditions under which we will sell the property, which changes dramatically from anything that had been prior to that. There is no response. No response for several months until the end of January 2002. A letter was written to Mr. Walton, copied to his attorney, that says, if there is a contract out there, it's terminated. It's void. It's vacated. Sometime thereafter, within the next month, a letter is sent. And that letter says, we are now ready, willing, and able, at your earliest convenience, to settle. That is all we have with regard to the issue of date. Nothing very specific. While I acknowledge that it is not an issue where we say that it is the type of term that is contained in real estate contracts, where they say time is of the essence, while it may not be of the essence, it certainly is something that is commercially reasonable that we have to look towards. And in this circumstance, we believe that the date, as it has not been established, is not reasonable.
Well, what was the purpose of the record plan then?
Initially, the purpose of the record plan, I believe, was to have conveyed the property or a portion of that property to Mr. Walton. I believe that was an accurate statement. However, even before the record plan was approved, it appeared, at least to the Beals, that there was not going to be a settlement. And the testimony in the record says that, from their perspective, as long as they had paid for the surveyor and as long as they had prepared the record plan, that someday they may sell it, and therefore they would want to go through with the record plan under any set of circumstances. Having already incurred the expense, there seems to be no point in just letting it languish.
Well, I'd like to hear your comment on the language in the record plan itself. It says purpose. And I brought a magnifying glass because it's not easy to read. It says to subdivide tax parcel number, and then it gives the number, into two parcels, parcel one and parcel two. Parcel two to become an integral part of tax parcel number, and then it gives a number. No new building lot is being proposed by this plan. Doesn't that translate that the purpose of this is to convey parcel two to the other side?
When the record plan was first established, as I believe I indicated, they believed that, in fact, that was going to be the case. Now, if the record plan and the surveys that go with it, of course, are developed by the engineer, not by the parties. They don't draft these documents themselves. They don't send them to the approving authorities themselves. The process is done through an engineer or an attorney. In this case, it was through the engineer. That is standard language in there, had they intended to transfer the property. And I would not disagree with you that had there been a transfer, that would have been appropriate. But if that were the case, Your Honor, I suggest that the settlement should have taken place within a month, 2 months at most, after that occurred. That is, it was approved in March. It should have taken place in April, May. Nothing was said. I think both parties acted as if it was, in fact, not intended for that purpose. And it continued to be that way, as I explained earlier, for the date circumstance, for a lot longer. I don't think that what was intended in this situation was what I have called an everlasting option. That is, that Mr. Walton had until he decided he wanted to purchase the property under terms that he says were the original terms, whatever those may be, but I assume indicate going back to 1999. It seems inappropriate that we would allow that kind of reading of the record plan to allow that kind of conduct. And we believe that that is inappropriate for that kind of situation. I would also ask the court to take a look at the price situation. There is no question that at one point in time the parties agreed to a specific price or to a generic price term, that is $11,000 an acre. However, it was not continued in that particular format. It changed. Even the contract of July 31, which had $11,000 per acre, did not include what is called the dogleg. Later on, the dogleg was included either at $6,600 an acre or at $11,000 an acre. No one is quite sure. The price then continued to be modified between the parties as they discussed the matters, even until such time as November 2001, when at the end, Ms. Beal, in writing a letter to Mr. Walton, said, "Do you want this property? And if so, we want the money, $116,000, to which there was no response. The price continued to change. And one of the reasons the price continued to change is, as Mr. Beal had said at one point in time when he received the November 2000 settlement sheet, time had passed and it was no longer the monies that he was looking for. It would seem inequitable, in my mind, to allow what was a price term, if it were a price term, in July of 1999, to continue to be the price term as it continued with no changes of any kind, no interest changes, no nothing. Just continue at that price until Mr. Walton should decide that he wanted to, in fact, exercise what he perceived to be his option to purchase the property. The third element of a real estate contract of this type is the property itself, that is, what is being transferred. In this case, we have an issue where there is significant issues about the configuration of what, in fact, is to be sold. When we have the contract in July of 31.
Have they inferred that that was resolved by the record plan?
You might, if you wanted to make that judgment, find that it was resolved by the record plan.
Well, did the Vice Chancellor do that?
I believe he did. However, I don't believe that he was correct in saying that that configuration, that is what was approved, was in fact approved at the time that all other issues were in fact resolved, because as I believe I said, the date was still in flux at the time that the record plan was in fact filed. And there's a question as to whether or not the price was also in the same fashion, the same as it was. Because in 1999, in the spring, or maybe even in 98, nobody is quite sure, there were discussions about configurations. And in fact, Mr. Walton provided Mr. Beale with several variations of different types of configurations that he felt would be appropriate. When they finally did the contract, or pardon me, I shouldn't call it a contract, when they finally did the document from July 31st, it merely said on it, as a survey shall describe. And the testimony was that Mr. Beale, at one point in time, went out with a surveyor and said, draw a line here. No discussion with Mr. Walton. That's what he did, and that's how the configuration was developed. There is no indication, I guess, other than the signing of the plan that would indicate that Mr. Walton agreed that that was the property which he was going to buy. I can't say that the court did not find that that was, in fact, the property that was to be sold. The last part of the requirement is that the purchaser be ready, willing, and able to conform to the purchase requirements. What we have here are two things. First, we have a $20,000 check that was given to the Beals. And the second thing we have is Mr. Walton's testimony that he obtained a $65,000 mortgage. One of the things that you need for part performance, or for something to be part performance of a contract, is a contract. And I suggest that the payment of the $20,000 could not be in furtherance of a contract when it was made, because there was no contract at that time, unless one wants to go to the July 31st document and call that a contract. But I believe that the court specifically said that was not the contract. Similarly, on the obtaining of the $65,000 mortgage, there is nothing in the record beyond Mr. Walton's bare statement that he took out a $65,000 mortgage. We have a period of time here from 1999 through early 2002. There's absolutely no evidence in the record that shows that that money was available to him throughout that period of time, and I suggest to you that would be unreasonable to think it was. But there was clearly nothing in the record to show that he had the ability to conform to the requirements of the contract, that is, to in fact pay the monies that were there.
Other than his testimony,
and all his testimony is, Your Honor, is that he took out a $65,000 contract. He does not say that he continued to hold the money in escrow. He does not say that he returned the money and could continue it as a line of credit. There's nothing other than a bald statement that says, I took out $65,000. I suggest that that is insufficient to establish what is required for ready, willing, and able.
Well, what is the rule of law that you're asking that we would establish then? What evidence is necessary?
For ready, willing, and able?
Yes.
I think that you would have to show that as of the date of when the settlement is supposed to be, that, in fact, you had the funds in order to be able to close on the property. One of the things in a normal real estate contract is a mortgage contingency, which says within a certain time frame you're going to ask for a mortgage, and then if you get a commitment letter, within a further period of time. And therefore, you know that you have the mortgage, and the mortgage stands for the fact that there is, in fact, adequate assurance that, in fact, the real estate will be able to be sold.
Appellee says in its brief that that testimony was unrebutted, and therefore it was fair for the trial judge to take that testimony as fact and just test it for credibility.
It is, I suggest to the court, impossible to disprove something of that nature. That came up, I have to say, at the trial, and it was not available. I had no opportunity, in my mind, to reasonably rebut it.
I take it he was cross-examined on that.
Yes, sir.
And didn't, as a result of cross-examination, produce any documents that substantiated the loan?
Nothing, Your Honor.
You're in your rebuttal time. Did you want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, members of the court. Mark D. Sisk from the Law Office of Mark D. Sisk in Wilmington and Newark, Delaware, here for Albert Walton this morning. May it please the court, we've said in our briefs, we've said in the Court of Chancery, we've said consistently in this case that this is a straightforward case of two parties, two neighbors with a previous course of dealing made a deal. They made a deal, and since the time they made that deal, the appellant has looked for what, not since the time, after a time elapsed, they began to look for a way out. The Court of Chancery wrote a careful opinion after a full-day trial in which it found that the contract that it enforced was unambiguous, and we think that is the correct position.
Now, what was the unambiguous settlement they agreed upon?
There was never an unambiguous settlement date, Your Honor, but as the as you pointed out in the question to Mr. Hyman, the date itself wasn't material. The party's prior course, rather casual, neighborly course of dealing, they did not set a settlement date. Things got ready. Mr. Hyman posed a question to you in response to your question about, I believe, what rule of law you were asking him to impose. And he said something like you should make sure the plaintiff is ready, willing, and able to close on the settlement date. Well, how could we ever pick a settlement date in this case? How could that ever be proved? And we think the testimony did prove it. We also think a substantial down payment in these two landowners who own significant parcels of land adjoining to one another. This isn't an insignificant transaction, but they aren't selling their entire parcels. We think he was ready, willing, and able. But how can we ever demonstrate that he was ready, willing, and able on any particular date when the settlement date was a moving target thanks to the Beals? Mr. Beals' own testimony said that when he got the draft settlement sheet in November of 2001, he didn't do anything with it. He didn't. His testimony was in the record that he ignored it. Thus, it's very difficult to point to a firm settlement date. Now, Mr. Walton, I would submit to you, tried on several occasions, the record is clear, to obtain a firm settlement date, and for whatever reason, first because the matter was ignored, then because Mr. Beal tried to restructure the deal, wanted to restructure the deal for reasons that are in the record, the deal never got to a settlement date. So I hope that answers your question. I would agree with the comments that were made, and we said in our brief, I'm not going to read you the brief, that the configuration issue, sure, the parcels went through, these people are neighbors, they went through plans, there were lots of drafts in the record, but when everyone signs off and everyone lodges a record plan with Newcastle County, and that plan, without getting into the total legal effect of that, that plan is still on the record. There's nothing in the record where Mr. Beal writes to Mr. Walton or counsel writes and says, you know what, this feels off. We need to undo this record plan now because that record plan is in the record. People searching titles are going to find that. Mr. Walton, as the trial court found, paid taxes on some of the lands to be conveyed before he even received him. There's nothing in the record indicating that the Beals at any time tried to undo that that parcel. the price term, I would submit to you, was found correctly by the trial court to be as it was stated in the November 20th settlement, in the November 2001 settlement sheet. Mr. Beal's own cross-examination, he was asked, is that, how is that compared to what you expected in the original agreement between the two of you? And he said it was about right.
When was the agreement completed?
I would submit, Your Honor, that the agreement was totally complete when that record plan was signed. They'd agreed prior to that, they'd agreed on a price. They had agreed generally on the configuration. They got that together, and then once that record plan was signed off on, I would submit everyone knew what was going to be conveyed at that point. And it was then a matter of finding a date and finding a time to do it.
So what constitutes a reasonable time running forward from that date for closing?
I think reasonableness is defined on a fact, on a case-by-case basis. In this case, the trial court found that the matter had lingered for a while, but not terribly long, and when the settlement sheet was tendered to Mr. Beal in November of 2001, in November of 2000, I don't think the trial court said these words, but that was, the trial court was not shocked by that, did not find that was any kind of an unreasonable delay on the facts of this matter, where these people had been neighbors, had done a prior transaction that was solely, as the trial court's opinion reflects, for the benefit of Mr. and Mrs. Beal, where Mr. Walton let them purchase a piece of frontage so they could obtain a bank mortgage. The trial court did not find that to be an unreasonable time. I think the answer to Your Honor's question is it's really a fact-based inquiry in each case, and the court found it was appropriate here. Had we gone to settlement in November, had the parties gone to settlement in November of 2001, had Mr. Beal not ignored that settlement sheet, or had he called someone and said, geez, I don't think this is what I intended, or the numbers aren't right, or whatever, had he come to the table one way or the other, we wouldn't be here, at least today, because the matter would have either been consummated at that point, or the parties would have known there was a breach at that point. Mr. Walton didn't know there was a breach until a considerable period of time later.
When was the deposit offered to be returned?
The deposit was offered to be returned in January of 2002. With the letter, there's a letter in the record from counsel dated, I believe, January 31st, 2002. I apologize for not recalling the exact date, but that's the approximate date. And that letter is in the record, and that is the first time that Mr. Walton, that the deposit was actually tendered back to Mr. Walton. Now, he didn't accept it. He still doesn't have it to this date. But the reason he still doesn't have it, candidly, is that he wouldn't accept it at that time. He thought there was still a contract going forward, and consistent with that theory, he shouldn't have his money back. With regard to the bank loan issue, there was lots of other evidence that Mr. Walton was ready, willing, and able to go forward. Again, as I said, the down payment. There was no significant cross-examination on this point. We've been in this case we've been in this case for 2.5-3 years by the time it got to trial. Mr. Walton's testimony, as the Chancery Court noted, was that not just that he had gotten this bank loan, but that on two occasions he had told Mr. and Mrs. Beal that he'd done it. They didn't contradict that in the record, at least the way I read that record. An issue before the court that you may wish to address or may wish me to address is the latches issue. We, again, believe latches is very much a fact-based inquiry. We think the ultimate piece of evidence in terms of the various delays in that matter was the letter. I would commend you the letter from Mr. Beal to Mr. Walton in November of 2001, which is every bit as important for what it doesn't say as for what it does say. It does confirm that there had been, it confirms, and this I believe is why the Chancery Court found Mr. Walton more generally credible, it does confirm that there had been a conversation about restructuring this deal for whatever reason to provide part of the proceeds in cash. Mr. Beal says now, well, this deal is off the table. And then that part of the deal is off the table. I'm now backing off of that. But that confirms everything that Mr. Walton said about the prior conversation the parties had had in April 2001, where they'd had a discussion. And for whatever reason, people want to have parts of monies and real estate transactions paid in cash. It's not a sin to think about it. They had a discussion. Mr. Walton's testimony was he left that discussion saying to his neighbor, "Gee, why don't you talk to your accountant? We're disagreeing about whether or not this is a 20% or 30% issue under the tax law. Why don't you go talk to your accountant about it?" The record does not reflect that Mr. Beal ever did that, but the record does reflect that in November of 2001, he writes back and confirms that aspect of the deal. The latches issue is a non-issue so far as we're concerned. Mr. Beal told us in cross-examination that he ignored a tendered settlement sheet. Mr. Walton told us that Mr. Beal did not follow up on the accountant issue. The November 21st, 2001 letter, for all the talk of deadlines, for all the talk of we need a line in the sand, we need something firm, there is still no deadline in that letter. And that letter is in the argument. That letter is in the record. Another Latch's argument was that there was some delay in responding to to counsel's letter. That letter was dated on January 30th, 2002, and I believe the response was 2 weeks later. I would submit to you that is not an unreasonable delay, and that Mr. Walton somehow delayed in asserting his rights by filing suit in July of that year. Well, analogizing this to a breach of contract statute of limitations situation, in January we now know there's a breach. The general context of statute of limitations, of course, is 3 years. We have a lawsuit filed in 3 to 4 months. If I might just have a moment, Your Honor. The record is replete that at all times any delays in this matter were caused by the Beals and not by Mr. Walton, and that he was ready, willing, and able to go to closing. The appellants artfully use the term the contract in reference to both the document that was signed, not signed in the summer of 1999, and what the trial court found to be the unambiguous contract later. There's a difference, I would submit, between the piece of paper that contains the time is of the essence clause and the contract which the court ultimately found and enforced. Certainly, if time was of the essence and the parties didn't go to settlement in November of 1999, there would be no contract, there would be nothing going forward. But if time was of the essence, why are we signing a subdivision and filing a subdivision plan in November of 2000? I beg your pardon, in March of 2000, signing off and recording that with the with Newcastle County.
What is in the record about the purpose of that plan other than what's on the plan itself? Is there testimony that this was entered into to carry out the original agreement of the parties?
That is my recollection of the record, Your Honor. The original agreement of the parties, I guess in a matter of contract law, the intentions don't matter so much, but my recollection of the record is that they did do this to carry out the original agreement. Why else would we be filing a plan? If Mr. Beal wanted to file a subdivision plan as to his own lands, he could file it at any time without reference to Mr. Walton. If Mr. Beal wanted to sell some land and get some money, Mr. Walton, as he testified and the Vice Chancellor found, isn't a land developer, isn't a builder, isn't a speculator. He's lived on this family farm. His family's had the ground for almost 100 years. He wanted to look at trees in the future instead of some kind of subdivision.
There's no, or is there a requirement in the subdivision regulations that adjoining property owners sign the plan?
My recollection of those regulations, and I can only speak to Newcastle County, Your Honor, as I've not done subdivision work in Kent and Sussex County.
Well, let's talk about this plan.
Very well. Is that it only is required to be signed by the adjoining owners if there's some if there's something coming or going from the material owner's land. There are notice requirements to the adjoining owner. When one files a subdivision, there's a notice. There's a period of time to object. If there are variances necessary or zoning things that are an issue, of course, the neighbors have time to object. But if we live next to each other in Newcastle County and I'm filing a subdivision plan that cuts my 10 acres into five so I can sell a piece to my brother, unless you're getting something or losing something, my understanding is that you're not required to sign the subdivision plan, that a neighbor would not be required to sign the subdivision plan. I respectfully have concluded my comments, and I would, unless the court has questions, I don't want to entertain it any further.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, I have a few brief moments, so let me talk about some of the things that I think are important. Delay. There's nothing in the record that suggests that the delay was caused by the Beals. They got the survey, they had the record plan signed, they had the record plan filed, and nothing happened. The settlement sheet was sent to them. On the record, it did not conform to their understandings. It also said, and I'm reading now from the letter of November 24, A15, Al Walton has not seen this, but I am sending him a copy of it. Wait, but I am sending a copy of it to him with his copy of this letter. Thus, any inaccuracies are my responsibility, not his. The settlement sheet and the letter indicate that Mr. Walton had not seen these documents. He had not approved them, nor was there any follow-up letter that said Mr. Walton has now seen it and he now agrees. There was nothing after that. It stopped. It ceased. There was no further communication until a discussion that took place in April, I believe, is the testimony of 2001. And that is confirmed, I believe, in the letter by Mr. Beal. And the letter is to Mr. Sisk, A17, that says, I spoke with Al Walton once since your letter of November 24, 2000, regarding the above. He was going to let us know of a decision on the $10,000 tax issue. I have not heard back from him. If Al is still interested in pursuing this property transaction, I would like him to finalize it sometime in the near future. Please let me know if Al is still interested in the property. That's the letter. It was to Mr. Sisk in November. Again, there was no response. December, the balance of November, December and January pass. There is no response until after a letter from the Beals Council that says the transaction is terminated, any contract that's out there is foreclosed. So I suggest to you that really it is not the Beals that caused this thing to linger. It was, in fact, the actions of Mr. Walton, who apparently, as Mr. Sisk has said, wanted to watch trees, but if he was going to watch trees, there was no reason he had to pay for it as long as he could have the Beals continue to own it, and he had an option at some time in the future to purchase whatever he wanted to based upon that record plan. I think it was a formulated situation. There was no reason for him to go forward. He was not a developer. He did not need the land. All he was doing was he wanted to foreclose its use as development or have somebody else have the option for that purpose. It was just as good for him to let it lie and do nothing as it was to, in fact, conclude the transaction. And I suggest that Latches does apply quite clearly with regard to this situation. If the contract was, in fact, in place when the record plan was signed in January 2000, it seems to me that the February 2002 to say we're ready, willing, and able to go forward does not meet the standards of reasonableness, whether or not time is of the essence or not. One last comment. I think what we're looking at here is Mr. Sisk would have us develop what's called the neighbor rule. That is, if you're going to have a contract with your neighbor for real estate, it doesn't have to meet the standards that real estate contracts have always had to meet throughout the common law and through Delaware's statute and case law. I think that's bad precedent, and I think it will lead to a bad situation were it to be adopted. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.